Many people know that hysterectomy affects the reproductive ability, but did you know that it also affects your brain? Even if you haven't had a hysterectomy, and if you are in menopause and under 51, this podcast is for you. Welcome to the Brain Podcast, where we discuss science-based, actionable strategies you can immediately implement to improve your brain function. We don't provide just more information, but we share exactly how to implement best practices for you to get consistent results. I'm Andrea Spiros, and I work with forward-thinking organizations to fuel innovation, foster well-being, and design for lasting change.
I am Dr. Shabnam Daskar. I'm a functional medicine doctor. I live in Alberta in Canada, and I'm interested in helping people maintain their brain function and prevent dementia down the line. And thank you, Andrea, for joining me here today.
I'm so excited to be part of this. I have to say, as a woman, this topic strikes fear in my heart. It just cuts to the core of who I think I am, and I think that this may be true for many others. Can you tell us what exactly is a hysterectomy?
So a hysterectomy is an operation for the removal of the uterus. Now, there are many different types of hysterectomies. And for our episode today, we are going to discuss only hysterectomy for benign conditions, non-malignant conditions. We are not talking about hysterectomy for cancerous conditions.
So tell us a little bit about that. There's more than one type. Tell us about the types of hysterectomy.
Okay. So as a former OBGY, I mean, hysterectomy was something that was fairly common back then. And I have not been practicing as an OBGY for a few years. But so number one is hysterectomy with the removal of both tubes and both ovaries, or hysterectomy with the removal of one ovary and tubes. So they are called hysterectomy with unilateral salpingo-oophorectomy or hysterectomy with bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. Those are just clever sounding words to tell people that if the word oophorectomy is used, that means the ovaries have been removed. So that is one is a total hysterectomy. So the uterus is removed. And then along with that, whether one ovary is removed or two ovaries are removed. And usually if ovaries are removed, the fallopian tubes are removed as well at surgery. That is one classification. The other classification is the approach to the surgery. So one is laparoscopic hysterectomy, which actually laparoscopic hysterectomy is using an endoscopic method to, you know, so the surgery is done through small little incisions and the uterus is removed either from below or it is morcellated into tiny pieces and can be removed from above as well. But laparoscopic hysterectomy is actually one of the best changes that could have happened in the hysterectomy world, because of, you know, various advantages, because post-operative pain, that is pain after the surgery, is a whole lot less. So that is laparoscopic hysterectomy. Next is abdominal hysterectomy. So you get an incision, usually it's along the bikini line. And so laparoscopic and abdominal hysterectomy are both done under general anesthesia usually, but it depends, it varies from doctor to doctor. But an abdominal hysterectomy is you get a bikini line incision and the operation is done. So that is the oldest way of doing hysterectomies. And the third type of hysterectomy is one that is done vaginally. So vaginal hysterectomy, the postoperative pain is a whole lot less. So, and which approach is used would obviously depend on the indication for hysterectomy, why your hysterectomy is being done. And more importantly, it'll also depend on what your doctor decides. So, Andrea, that's a lot of information.
That's great. And this is, and what we are here to empower people to have a more productive conversation with their doctors. So there are two kinds of hysterectomy and then several types of surgeries around those. What I heard you saying was there's one that's just the uterus and where the ovaries and fallopian tubes do remain. And then there's another where they don't, and then there's a maybe one ovary will remain or not. So these are things that you want to ask your doctor about if they're appropriate for you, but know that there is more than one type of hysterectomy out there in terms of what's going on in your body. Now, the other thing is that there are different types of surgeries. So there's two things you need to know when you're having a conversation with your doctor is one, what exactly are they going to remove? And then also, how are they going to remove it? Because there's varying degrees of invasiveness and in recovery, you can recover with less pain with some of the others. Now, we want you to choose what's appropriate for you for what's going on in your situation, and that's going to involve a conversation with your doctor. The other thing that's important to know, in not in just choosing it, but what else do people need to know besides these things, women in particular, before choosing a hysterectomy?
Andrea, one of the things that we didn't know a lot about a few years ago was the relationship between hysterectomy and brain function down the line. And so what we used to think back then, and unfortunately, this information has not reached every doctor yet. And one of the reasons we have this episode today is to make more people aware of that. So what we used to think back then is if a woman is having a hysterectomy for a non-cancerous condition, we can leave behind both the ovaries or even one ovary, and she is not going to go into menopause right away. Okay. So when we talk about menopause, again, there are two types of menopause. One is surgical menopause. That means a woman gets into menopause as soon as she has a surgery to remove the uterus. And the other one is natural menopause, which is the menopause most women go through. And we used to think that if we kept even one ovary behind, or even better, if we kept both ovaries behind, the women will not go into menopause right away. But that turns out to be untrue. So the moment someone has a hysterectomy, even if one or both ovaries are left behind, it still is a sudden menopause. Versus a natural menopause is a much more long drawn out and more, you know, evened out process, though, well, there is nothing really evened out about menopause. But this was a major change in thinking, which, you know, we thought, oh, we're leaving both the ovaries behind. She's not going to have all the problems of menopause right away. But a lot of research has shown, and we are going to post the papers in the show notes. So what has changed? This is like really big change in our thinking is that a hysterectomy for even if you leave the ovaries behind is going to impact a woman's brain function down the line. Now, sometimes that, influence on brain function, some women notice it right away. And for some women, it may happen that they have cognitive decline, which can be, there are many different types of dementias. Alzheimer's is one of them. So they may experience early cognitive decline. So let us say they did not have a hysterectomy, whether it was with the ovaries removed or without the ovaries removed. And they would have, let us say, not had any cognitive decline down the line, versus having an early hysterectomy, early meaning before the age of natural menopause, that changes their risk for dementia and cognitive decline down the line. Now, Andrea, I don't want our episode to just be a discussion of doom and gloom.
No, we're not about doom and gloom here, no. But we do need to inform you. And so we're going to get to the positive.
Yes. So in case you're already feeling, I've already had a hysterectomy and I'm just 45 years old. No, we do have some hopeful message for you down the line. So the next important factor is for women who are planning, let us say your doctor has suggested that you need to have a hysterectomy because you have, and I'm going to talk a little bit about all the conditions, possible reasons why you might have a hysterectomy. But I want you to, both Andrea and I want you to have enough information so that you can make a, you know, a wise decision based on what is going on with you. Because back when I was an OBGY, Andrea, I never discussed about brain health when it came to a conversation about a hysterectomy.
It was too new, I'm sure. And they didn't, the research just wasn't there. And now we have more research. And I don't think we're saying here that your brain function is beyond repair. It's just something that you should know now that we have the links in the science to show that hysterectomy can affect brain function. There are things that you can do to support a better brain function if you're have a hysterectomy or if you're under the age of 51 and are going through menopause. So we're here to give you a positive, hopeful message.
Yes. And so I'm going to just digress a little bit to define menopause because, you know, the medical definition of menopause is not having menstrual cycles for 1 year, so, which means it is sort of a retrospective diagnosis. So you may be in menopause at 6 months, but, you know, it's not 1 year yet. So you are told by your doctor, oh, it's just been 6 months. You're not really in menopause. But that is not really true. So here is, you know, a little bit about definition. And in science, we like to have definitions so that we know we are comparing apples with apples.
Right, right.
Yeah, but with menopause, it's like, oh, okay, now you've completed 12 months. So today you are, now you're in menopause kind
of. You graduate. You got your menopause graduation cap. Yes.
So, and you brought up something very important, Andrea. You talked about women less than 51 years of age. So the natural age of menopause in most North American countries, and I think European countries as well, is 51. But in some countries, I know in India, there are just one or two papers which showed that women go through menopause at an earlier age. So it's about 46. Bottom line is, what we are talking about today applies equally to people who have gone through menopause earlier, whether it is a part of hysterectomy or it's a natural menopause as well. So you talked about, we are talking about hysterectomy here, but I want to digress for 1 minute and go to an area where a woman goes through, goes through menopause without having surgery, but she is much younger and particularly below the age of 40. And why I'm bringing this up, because one of the reasons women have hysterectomy is something called endometriosis. And I will go into endometriosis a little bit in details. So what happens is women below 40 may go through either menopause without surgery, or it could also be women who have endometriosis and they are having a surgery with the removal of uterus tubes, ovaries, and the uterus before the age of 40. So those women, this is guideline recommended treatment. They are recommended to go through, use hormone therapy. They should ask the doctor for hormone therapy.
Right.
Because not having hormone therapy, if you have gone through menopause very early in life, is actually not just bad for your brain, it's also bad for your bones, for heart health. And I'm talking about just the non-cancerous ones. I'm not talking about cancer here.
Exactly.
Yeah, that is a message, Andrea. I was listening to someone, she had written something about having a hysterectomy for endometriosis. So endometriosis is actually a very painful condition and a lot of women suffer quite a lot. And sometimes they are not diagnosed early enough if the doctor is not thinking of it. So what happens in endometriosis is basically the lining of the uterus, which bleeds every month. So that's a menstrual cycle. Those kind of bleeding areas of the uterus, instead of being in just inside the uterus, those deposits are there in other areas as well. So it could be on the ovaries, it could be in other places in the abdomen, it could be on the tubes. So a lot of women have very painful cycles, and some of them even have problems getting pregnant. And endometriosis pain can be really disabling. And recently, a lot of studies have come up which show that women with endometriosis, this came out in, I think, the American Journal of Cardiology. I will post all the papers in the show notes. because Andrea, I'm sure you are similar to me. Like if someone talks about a paper and they don't add it to the notes, I'm like, why did they talk about a paper and not
get that's it? Right. You got to give me the full information. Even if I'm not going to read it right away, I want to know what it is so I can dive a little deeper. And because I think our listeners are really as interested in the details as we are, we want to provide them as much information as possible so that they can make really good informed decisions, especially with something like hysterectomy. So definitely check out the show notes.
Yes. So another thing that a recent paper came out is women who have had, who have endometriosis and have had hysterectomies, their incidence for stroke is much higher than women who have not gone through all this. And what they found is most of that risk is related to the hysterectomy as much as the endometriosis. So it could be that endometriosis is also a state of high inflammation. And we talk about high inflammation being related to 95% of chronic disease. Brain health is one of them. So in endometriosis, one of the things that happens, Andrea, is women are like, let us say they've already completed the family, they've had the babies they wanted, and the pain is so disabling that, you know, they've had medications for it, but it's still not better. They just decide, okay, I think I'll be fine if I have a hysterectomy and everything is gone. I'm like sick and tired of the pain.
Yeah.
So my point is, so maybe if you know that it might affect your brain function down the line. And again, this will not happen to everybody, but it's important to know, that it can affect your brain. So you might make a different decision. So endometriosis is one of the indications for early hysterectomy. And in endometriosis, hysterectomies, usually both tubes and ovaries are removed at surgery as well. Now, and I'm digressing again a little bit into, so there was a thinking back then, and data didn't support it, that, okay, if you remove the uterus, tubes, ovaries, everything, you're going to reduce a woman's risk for ovarian cancer.
Right. That would seem to be logical. They're not there. So.
Exactly. And one of the unfortunate things, and I'm sure there is, I mean, a lot of research is happening in that area. Ovarian cancer is one cancer that often gets diagnosed very late. And because of that, the prognosis is not very good. But the fact is, and I remember years ago, Andrea, I remember having this conversation with an oncosurgeon in the hospital where I was working in Mumbai. So he said, oh, you've just done a hysterectomy. Did you remove her tubes and ovaries as well? And back then I was still thinking that if I keep the ovaries behind, I'm not going to get her into menopause early.
Right.
So why would I remove the ovaries? She doesn't have cancer. He said, no, you're going to prevent ovarian cancer. I said, but ovarian cancer, number one, is a much lower risk, a much lower incidence. So not a lot of women get ovarian cancer, though unfortunately they may get diagnosed late. And I told him, I said, you know what? She's not going to die of ovarian cancer, but she might die of dementia or early heart disease. Because he was an oncosurgeon, so obviously he was thinking of, you know, cancer first.
Exactly. And it goes to show that the lens that we view things through can inform the decisions that we make. And it's whatever lens you choose is fine, but we just want to be aware of that. And it's also your story share just how things are changing, right? And how the quote unquote logical, every person's general public thinking of like, well, remove the ovaries, reduce the risk of cancer, doesn't always play out, you know, the same way. And so you need to really think a little bit differently about how you're making these decisions. So if you're listening to this, we're giving you information so that you can make the right decision for you. We're not saying you should or shouldn't do these things. But it's, I think, as a woman who's heard about ovarian cancer and had someone die in my life from it, it does get diagnosed late and oftentimes it is fatal. And so it is a big worry. But as you so rightly point out, the risk isn't as great as we might think it is.
Yeah. So next is another indication for hysterectomy in non-cancerous states is fibroids. So fibroids are these benign tumors of the uterus, and they can be of various sizes. Sometimes the fibroids can be really large. And I myself actually had a hysterectomy at an early age. Back then, I didn't know enough. But I was fortunate to be put on hormones early in my life. So that saved me. And I think sometimes many of us in the functional medicine world, our journey starts with helping ourselves first.
Yes, yes.
So I had a fibroid for a long time. And so fibroids, again, can be different sizes. And it depends. You can have a laparoscopic hysterectomy. I have some wonderful colleagues who are great laparoscopic surgeons, and they can take care of even very big fibroids. And sometimes women are told, your fibroid is too big, you can't have a surgery to remove only the fibroid. So that's a surgery called a myomectomy, not a hysterectomy. So they'll say, sometimes patients are told it's too big, it can't be taken care of, get rid of everything together. So if that is something you are thinking, and you are just, you know, in your early 30s or maybe just 40 years old, then maybe you need to pause and think what it means instead of having a hysterectomy. Is it, and again, this is not a conversation that Andrea and I are going to have with you here. This
exactly. We're giving you talking points and questions so that you can have a productive conversation with your healthcare provider.
Yes. And so what you need to find out is, can doing a myomectomy, that means just removing the fibroids and not the whole uterus and tubes and everything, can that help you or at least postpone all the problems for a few more years until you go into natural menopause? So that is one of the areas. And sometimes, you know, and Andrea, I understand sometimes with fibroids, women bleed a lot. And when they bleed, it's like, it's horrible, like, you know, working and everything together, and you have to be constantly worried about that. Then you lose a lot of blood, you become deficient, iron deficient, and iron deficiency is one of the worst possible things. You feel terrible, you're fatigued, you don't have enough energy, you're taking care of families, and women just decide, I've had enough.
So and people want to feel better. And so,
yeah. And it's like, okay, if I have a hysterectomy, the problem is gone once and for all. But so maybe now you might want to think a little differently about that. And one more thing I wanted to highlight is endometriosis is not a cancerous condition. So if you have had a hysterectomy for endometriosis, you can still go for hormone therapy. And before I talk about hormone therapy, Andrea, is there anything else that we need to clarify?
I think we should talk about, because hormone therapy is going to be one of the solutions, potential solutions. So let's talk about exactly what happens to the brain in the situation where either you're, you know, in early menopause or due to hysterectomy.
Excellent question. So obviously, you know, most of us are thinking, oh, the uterus tubes and ovaries are like down below and the brain is up there.
Far apart. How are they?
You know, this is where I tell people, in the body didn't get the memo that the brain is not supposed to communicate with any other organs. Likewise, you know, the ovaries should not communicate with the brain. It's just that these medicine has divided them artificially. So it's like when I was an OBGY, I used to say, I'm just below the belt, you know, what happens above. But what we do know now, and again, we still need lot of studies, but one of the things that we do know is what studies have found that, so the ovaries produce the hormones, you know, estrogen, progesterone, and it is the levels of estrogen, progesterone are different in different time of the cycle. And during the perimenopausal period, the 8 to 10 years before menopause, sometimes hormone levels can go really, like estrogen can be very high, progesterone can be very low. But the important thing to remember here is estrogen and progesterone and testosterone, women make some testosterone too, though testosterone usually we think of like muscular men, but women make, and men make some estrogen too, but that's for another conversation. So And hormones like testosterone, estrogen, progesterone are also called neurosteroids. So neuro meaning nerve tissue. Steroids is the chemical structure of these hormones. So what it means is these hormones have influences on our brain. And in fact, the brain can even locally make these hormones. But obviously, the level of these hormones in your blood, which would come from the ovaries as well, would also decide on how much of the hormones go into the brain. And the fact that the brain has the ability to make them locally, that just tells us how important these hormones are.
Right.
So after a hysterectomy, what happens is there is a dramatic fall in these hormones. And there is another hormone called the anti-Müllerian hormone, AMH. Many of you may be familiar with AMH if you're looking at your fertility. So that is one of the hormones. It's a blood test, which is often done when women go in for fertility checkups and things like that. So they found that AMH levels actually dramatically fell just after a hysterectomy, even when the ovaries were retained. So these neurohormones, which affect the brain, their levels drastically fall, and that causes a lot of the problems. And why that happens, again, this is where we are, like, we don't know for sure, but one of the reasons could be that the target organ is not there. So the target organ is the uterus, because estrogen, progesterone, they function, they work on the lining of the uterus and make it, you know, ready for to receive a pregnant, a fertilized ova. So a progesterone, the name itself is like gestation is pregnancy. So it is promoting pregnancy. So as someone said, you know, Andrea, women are either, so the estrus cycle is supposed to be, you know, where it makes you moody and things like that. So right. Women are either going mad or they're getting pregnant.
and that's the power of our hormones and the brain.
Yeah,
right.
I think we need some new names for these hormones. But anyway,
I think you're right. I think we do need some new names for these hormones. So, what would it look like to someone? So that's the mechanics of the hormones and how and why that something that is so far away from the brain is actually affecting it. What are people going to see in their daily life in terms of brain function that they can point to so that then we can give them, so they can, I think a lot of this is that people might just assume that this is part of aging and not really think it's part of the hysterectomy. So let's outline, like, what are they going to see in their daily life in terms of brain function or lack of brain function after this?
Excellent question, as always, Andrea. So we are going to post the link to a form, which is actually, it lists the symptoms of menopause. Now, when we talk about menopause, the commonest thing people talk about is hot flashes. Now, not everyone experiences hot flashes. In fact, in Asian countries, they have more of aches and pains. However, when it comes to brain function, what are some of the things? Some women, the commonest one is sleep problems. They're not able to sleep well. And again, as you said, you know, people think, oh, I'm just growing old. But it could be that, yes, age is one of the factors, but it could just be that you've had a hysterectomy recently. So maybe that is the reason why you can't sleep well. Another factor, important factor, is anxiety. And one more thing, which is often, you know, oh, she's just being a woman. Some women experience a lot of crying spells. Things like, you know, maybe you're just watching something on TV and you are not the crying kind of a person, but you suddenly break out in tears. Like, I'm sure, Andrea, you've seen people like that.
Yes. Well, and when I was pregnant, which is a period of high hormones, there were a few times where just something small made me burst into tears, and I didn't really realize what it was. And I think that a lot of people might consider that a flaw, especially if you're older and you're thinking like, or tough, you feel like you're a little bit tougher. Why am I crying? What's wrong with me? Right. So we're here to tell you that there's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah. And there are solutions for that. So that could be one of the things. And again, I've talked about aches and pains. So other than the brain, so anxiety, depression, insomnia, weepiness, and generally feel not feeling great, brain fog. A lot of women have experienced brain fog. So basically, a lot of the menopausal symptoms, instead of you experiencing them, you know, down the line when you would have had your natural menopause, these are kind of getting accelerated. And sometimes, you know, I remember back then we used to tell patients, okay, you know, you just had a major surgery, so give yourself some time to recover. So, yes, and those are important as well. But at the same time, there's another factor where all these things impact how your brain functions. And that is something very important to keep in mind. So I think, Andrea, it's time we talked about some of the solutions, right?
Yes, let's get to the solutions. So now we've talked about what a hysterectomy is, the types of hysterectomy, the why you might need to have one, and some of the things that happen to your body and to your brain. We are all about solution here. So let's talk about some of the solutions to have a better brain post-hysterectomy.
So all the other things about, you know, good lifestyle, good sleep, eat well, move more, you know, build up your stress resilience, all those apply. But in addition to that, what I really want to highlight is hormone therapy. Now, hormone therapy, unfortunately, Andrea, you know, the message out there is still that hormone therapy is harmful for you. It's going to kill you, give you cancer. The fact is, and I talk about this in greater details in one of the other episodes called Women, Hormones, and the Brain. So I have my associate, Dr. Natasha Iyer. So we dive a little more deeper into the details of the hormones. But a lot of women were left afraid of hormone therapy when a few years ago, the Women's Health Initiative study came out. So this was, I think, in 2003. And I don't know whether you remember, then you were much younger, so it didn't apply to you. So it was, oh, hormones are going to kill you. They give you more cancer. They do this, they do that. But the message now is very different because science has shown that the hormone therapy that was used back then was something called conjugated equine estrogens. So these were estrogens which were given orally. And there was something else called medroxyprogesterone acetate, and that is not progesterone. So oral estrogens are the ones that are that increase your inflammation levels, that increase clotting. So, Andrea, one of the major concerns a lot of women have is, I have a history of, you know, my family has a history of clotting, more clotting in them, and hormones are going to make it worse. So the point to remember is oral estrogens are the troublesome ones. If you apply estrogen as a cream or a patch on the skin, that does not increase clotting, that does not increase inflammation. And the type of estrogen that, and this is something that's available in most places in the world. So this is something called 17-beta-estradiol. And again, my apologies for the long names. But
well, you didn't create the names.
I didn't create them. So 17-beta-estradiol is the estrogen that your body makes. And these patches and creams give you that estrogen versus the, we used to call them the horsey estrogens by mouth.
Yes, yes.
Very different. Yeah. The horsey ones are very different. And we are not talking about, you know, this is not comparing apples and apples. So hormone therapy today is estrogen as a patch or cream on the skin and progesterone as oral micronized progesterone. So that is progesterone, which is, you know, chemically the structure is the same as the progesterone that your body makes. So one area, Andrea, where functional medicine doctors differ from traditional medicine is in, you know, standard of care, a woman who's had a hysterectomy is usually never given progesterone because the thinking was, and it still is, unfortunately, in many areas, is if you don't have a uterus, you don't need progesterone because you don't need to prevent cancer, because giving a woman only estrogens without progesterone, if she has a uterus, is going to raise her risk for cancer.
Interesting.
But Yeah, so functional medicine doctors, we recommend estrogen and progesterone for all women, whether they have a uterus or they don't. So, you know, this is something I tell people. So when a woman has a hysterectomy, does it mean she also needs to lose her brain along with her uterus? So you don't need progesterone. Progesterone is actually a hormone that makes, you know, the brain calmer. In fact, a derivative of progesterone is being used as a pharmaceutical preparation for things like epilepsy and all that. So it is, but somehow when women have a hysterectomy, we just assume we just need to protect them from cancer and forget about everything else. So right. That is one area. So you need to talk to your doctor and find out, because not everyone is trained in hormone therapy. It is very important to find the right practitioner. So you will know. I tell my patients, do you feel comfortable talking to this doctor when you brought this up? And sometimes they say, no, I don't think my doctor knows enough about this.
And that's really important. I mean, I think that because we're here to empower people to have this more productive conversations, that is one of the most important things. If you don't feel comfortable with that doctor and you don't feel that they're knowledgeable enough, but even just your comfort factor, maybe that's a sign to do a little bit more research and find someone who you are comfortable speaking with, who is open to this and knowledgeable about it.
Yes. And another important factor is when it comes to hormone therapy, there is a window of opportunity. So this is what is called the timing hypothesis in hormone therapy. So getting hormone therapy earlier in menopause rather than later shows a whole lot more benefits, particularly in terms of, we are talking about the brain. So brain health, heart health, and bone health as well. But guidelines will not say that you need to be on hormone therapy to save your brain. The guidelines will say that you need to be on hormone therapy if you have symptoms of menopause. Now, the fact is, the symptoms of menopause are not just hot flashes. Andrea, I still find, so my colleague here in Calgary, she is known for her hormone therapy. And so often we found patients telling us, oh, I asked my doctor for hormone therapy and he told me I don't have hot flashes, so I don't need hormones. But I can't sleep. I have terrible anxiety. I feel horrible. So do you think I qualify for hormone therapy? So that is the reason. I'm going to post the link to the list of symptoms and the North American Menopause Society's guidelines, and that is a guideline which is supported by all the major, you know, guidelines in the world, which says that if women experience these menopausal symptoms, hormone therapy is recommended. And again, like I explained, the caveat, someone who has had hormone-dependent cancers will not qualify for hormone therapy. But if we are talking about benign conditions here.
Exactly.
Yeah. So my point is, don't be afraid of hormone therapy. You need to know more to make a better decision, and don't just a blanket recommendation. Oh, it's going to give me cancer. No.
Exactly. And that is the key here, is that things are going to be right for you. And we want you to match yourself with what's right for you so that you can have the best brain and the best aging process that you can have. What else do people need to know about some solutions for better brain function?
So another important thing to keep in mind is, I am not suggesting that hormones will solve all your problems. So
they're not a magic wand?
No, not a magic potion or a magic pill. So some of you, if you are, let us say you're not sleeping well, you need to find out how you can sleep better. And I'm not saying hormones will solve all your problems, but maybe hormones are one of the solutions you can look into. And more importantly, Andrea, we are going to have more episodes where we talk about food particularly. So what are the food that will help you feel better? Now, there is no food which will actually give you, estrogen and progesterone. And particularly sometimes you'll find these conversations where, oh, you can get, plant estrogens from soy. No. Plant estrogens from soy are not going to make the same type of estrogen. Because this is, again, that fear, the feeling of fear of hormone therapy.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that that is, we're all about dispelling fear and empowering people. So if you've been afraid of hormone therapy, if you've been afraid of eating soy, take a deep breath.
So yes, soy and, you know, plant estrogens are not going to solve a lot of your problems, but you know, it's up to you. You decide what is important for you. So that is one more thing. And again, you know, movement. So hormone therapy is not going to give you what movement and exercise gives you. So that is again important, but you, both of us are trained Tiny Habits coaches. So we always talk about what is it that you want to do. So if sleep is not something you want to focus on right away, but you want to eat better, so maybe start focusing on that rather than, and then of course have this conversation with your doctor as well. So is there anything else, Andrea, we need to talk about?
I think that you've highlighted really well the problems, the potential problems and pitfalls, the solutions that people can take. And this is a multi-pronged approach that's going to be custom to you. And so in closing, we really hope that we have empowered you to have a more productive conversation with your healthcare provider so that you can match yourself with what you need in terms of hysterectomy and post-hysterectomy treatment so that your brain can function at its best. And if you want more info on this, definitely listen to Women, Hormones, and the Brain, an earlier podcast that Shabnam did, and check out the show notes for those links. Also, as always, if you've enjoyed this content, please like, subscribe, share, and review. See you next time.
Bye now.